Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Resolute Square.
There was also maintained what was called an enemies list, which was rather extensive and continually being updated.
Democrats want Republicans dead.
Where I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and I wouldn't lose any voters, okay?
The women with the least likelihood of getting pregnant are the ones most worried about having abortions.
On January 6th of 2021, you had tens of thousands of people peacefully protesting.
No, it's not a right-wing conspiracy theory. It's not QAnon. It's real.
I'm Rick Wilson, and this is The Enemies List.
I'm delighted to have Sarah McCammon today on The Enemies List. You have heard of Sarah, and you know Sarah's work and voice from National Public Radio, where she is the national political correspondent and the co-host of the NPR Politics podcast. Sarah understands what's going on in American politics. She covers it from the ground up and understands really what the shaping forces, what the driving forces are underneath a lot of the political conversations. And one of those big driving forces is the evangelical movement in America. She has a tremendous book called The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. And Sarah, welcome to The Enemies List today. I'm so happy we're finally able to get this show recorded. And I wanted to start out by asking you, this is a journey you understood personally and that you've seen directly. Tell us a little bit about what motivated you to write this book. And what's your sort of biggest takeaway is on it? And then I want to drill down into the details.
Sure. And thank you so much for having me. I've interviewed you before. I enjoy listening to your show. So this is fun for me. You know, I grew up evangelical in the Midwest in the 80s and 90s. At the time, I thought we were sort of like a small oppressed movement of sort of true Christians. That was what was presented to me. I had no idea how politically influential this movement I was growing up in was. And I sort of, to one degree or another, and we can get into that if you want to, for various reasons, moved away from it in my adult years. I went to an evangelical college, married a Southern Baptist pastor's kid in my early 20s, kind of followed the playbook, and then had wrestled with a lot of different aspects of evangelicalism. Not rejecting Christianity, not rejecting God, just struggled with aspects of the culture and some of the beliefs that I'd been presented with, and kind of privately had my own journey out of that. I'm in my 40s now, so this was 20 years ago. I professionally, as a journalist, found journalism to be a refreshing and exciting place to work because there were no preconceived answers I was supposed to arrive at. In fact, I was encouraged by my training to seek out multiple perspectives, which was something I hadn't always been encouraged to do. So I spent a lot of time away from the evangelical world. And then, long story short, Rick, I found myself right in the thick of it in the 2016 campaign. I was assigned to cover the Republican primary, and suddenly Donald Trump and the white evangelical movement were the story. And I couldn't look away from it. I saw a lot of things that I recognized from my childhood, and I wound up covering it as a journalist, of course, but also fascinated because of my own personal connections. And from that experience, and then from some of the conversations I started to see playing out in public spaces online, mostly social media spaces, among other people who'd grown up like I did at that moment, talking about what it all meant, that was sort of where this book came from.
You write about the contradictions that you started to feel and see more clearly, and some of the contradictions that were always present, but you weren't as conscious of. And I'm not an evangelical, so I have a sort of externalized perspective on it. But to me, as somebody who always was around them in the Republican process, there was always a sort of like two worlds of the evangelical movement. There was the vast majority of people who were honest, God-fearing, good people who lived in a culture and a community that wasn't really hate driven, that wasn't really the sort of politicized other half or other part of that movement. It seems to me, at least as an outsider from this, that at this point we now have an evangelical white Christian movement in the country that the rank and file have become very engaged in the politicized part of what used to be a tiny faction of the leadership or a tiny faction of folks who really believed that they weren't getting solutions in the culture. And it seems like that has inverted completely.
Right. And I think based on my own observation and talking to a lot of people who think about this, I think it's important to understand that there was always a political project associated with evangelicalism, at least all of my life. I was born 2 weeks after Ronald Reagan was inaugurated.
There has always been politics in that, yes.
Always, for my entire life. But I think it has become intertwined with and infused with the theological, spiritual, and religious project in a way it wasn't always. And I think, to your point, I think that infusion has spread sort of to the masses, to the rank and file. Now, when I was growing up, most evangelical I knew would have been conservative. They would have voted Republican, not all, but most. But I think that there's a consciousness of politics and an increasing appetite for extremism in some segments of the evangelical world, far more than there once was. So it's new, but it's not new. You know, the roots have been there for a long time, but I think evangelical has increasingly become a political label, at least as much as a theological or spiritual one. And that part feels new.
And the political project that evangelicals have embraced, it seems to me, has in a really meaningful way been defined by the rejection of modernity, the rejection of contemporary culture, the rejection of, in a big way, two central things, LGBT matters and abortion. The abortion argument is easier for me to understand than the LGBT side in some ways, because there's always been a cross flow of gay evangelicals. They've always been out there. They've always been part of the church, part of the culture, part of the community, not maybe publicly, but so those two areas, I have a theory of the case. I'm going to run this by you. When gay marriage burst onto the American sort of cultural scene, it was one of the fastest cultural transitions we've ever had in this country. I mean, it went much smoother and much more deep into the society than almost any other cultural change we've had in a very long time. I know a lot of evangelicals had a sense of shock and sort of horror about it. They were like, oh my God, how has this been forced down our throats? Why is this being forced on us? Was that like the catalyzing moment that led a lot of these people into the political wing of the evangelical movement?
I don't know. I think if anything, I think for a lot of younger evangelicals, it was the opposite. And maybe that is sort of a moment of crossover, a threshold moment for people, how they responded to that. Because there's a lot of data, and there has been for a number of years, that suggests that younger evangelicals are much more comfortable with LGBTQ rights, much more friendly to gay marriage than their predecessors. And not that young. I'm talking my generation, millennial and below. And so I think maybe it was a shock to some of the, you know, the powers that be, the older leadership, to see that quick cultural acceptance. I think for, you know, I mean, I remember as a young person wrestling with this, being taught, you know, evangelical moral beliefs about homosexuality. One of the central figures in my book is my grandfather, who I don't think it spoils too much to say came out late in life. And that was an important part of the story and an important part of the tension I felt was sort of watching my family, my fundamentalist evangelical family, respond to him. But I remember wrestling with this and thinking, well, why is it that we have these beliefs about, you know, marriages between a man and a woman, but why is it necessary then to make that the law of the land? And I think that for, you know, for an older generation of evangelicals, it was just, this is what's right and wrong. This should be the law. For younger evangelicals, it's, you know, especially in a world where you have gay friends, or a lot of evangelical young people grow up and realize they are gay, you know, it shapes the way that you look at, I mean, I think fundamentally it helps us see the humanity of gay people. It shouldn't be hard to see, but if you're cloistered in an environment where you're told that this is against God's design, it's, you know, it creates a barrier. And so, you know, for me, it was knowing my grandfather and loving him that sort of opened my mind to thinking about that differently. And we live now in a world where, you know, communication is fast, where there is wide cultural acceptance of gay people, as there should be. And I think that that has, it's certainly shaped the way that younger generations look at this within the church.
Support for Rick Wilson's The Enemies List comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/Wilson. That's odoo.com/Wilson. Odoo, modern management made simple.
I came out in favor of gay marriage, if that's the correct way to use that term of art, back in the early 2000s, because I am a pretty decent reader of the cultural river, and I'd been public about it since back then. But in 2012 or 13, I guess, I wrote something in Politico about it, and Rush Limbaugh lost his damn mind on me for like an hour one day, just put me on the flamethrower. And I cannot tell you what that does when you're still a Republican consultant to your world. It sort of like melts it down a bit. But the most fascinating part of it was I heard from so many of my very evangelical friends who were like, thank you for saying that. You know, my cousin, my friend, my brother, my uncle, whatever. And in my case, it was my two sisters. God bless, right? And I didn't approach it from a religious perspective. It was a libertarian perspective. Like, what government, what business of the government's is this? It's not.
Sure. Can I ask, this might be a tangent, but what was Limbaugh's argument? I mean, Limbaugh was he was a fascinating figure because he was in some ways kind of a precursor to Donald Trump, right?
Absolutely.
Not an observant man himself, but somebody that evangelicals resonated with. I think they resonated with that sort of fighting back against the culture, right? So what was his argument?
That the Washington liberal elite consultant class, and while I may have been in the elite consultant class, I haven't lived in D.C. since 1993, but okay, was trying to break the spirits of the Republican base and the evangelical movement. We were trying to force our liberal Washington beliefs down their throats. That was essentially the argument. And you know, it's interesting you say that he was a sort of precursor to Trump, because for all that Rush Limbaugh preached the conservative gospel, the guy was kind of a degenerate. I mean, honest answer. He was not this sort of upstanding moral figure in his private and personal life and everything else.
And he didn't really pretend to be.
No, I know, which is kind of refreshing in a weird way. But which brings us to Donald Trump. Something my Democrat and liberal friends cannot understand is the embrace of Trump is so intense and so passionate and so desperate at a certain level. Explain to us what in the character of the sort of modern evangelical white Christian movement allows that contradiction, that the multiply divorced, serially adulterous, lying, cheating, cruel, disrespectful, inhumane, all those things that are the antithesis of the stated value set. Explain to our guests or to our listeners how that works in their heads, how they justify that kind of a departure.
Well, it operates on a couple of levels. I mean, the simplest is instrumental and pragmatic. Trump will get me what I want. I heard, you know, some version of that many times covering the 2016 campaign. It's a binary choice between Clinton and Trump. Trump aligns with my policies, Clinton doesn't. Of course, we saw in this 2024 primary that when given lots of other choices that aligned with their policies, Republicans still chose Trump, and white evangelicals have chosen Trump in overwhelming numbers once again. So it operates on that level for sure, but not only on that level. And I think the best explanation from my research, from my reporting, from talking to people is this idea that Trump is a fighter. He's a fighter against the culture that we see as in decay, as decadent. And I'm saying we in the voice of evangelicals, not myself personally, but that evangelicals see as in decline, as rejecting God. They certainly, many of them see the white acceptance of LGBTQ people as part of that. They see declining influence of Christianity and the larger culture as part of that. And let's be honest, our culture does face a lot of problems, right? I mean, we are not a perfect country, but they're making a connection between these things in their minds, and they've been led to by their leaders. I mean, this is the messaging I heard from a very young age, which was from people like David Barton, who is a discredited historian, and many others. We were founded as a Christian nation. If we keep following along with Christ and maintain that identity, we will be strong and successful. If we don't, we will fall apart. Of course, ignoring many of the failures of that quote unquote Christian nation, you know, slavery and the treatment of indigenous people at the top of the list. Those things were not highlighted in that conversation. But I think that's the mindset that a lot of evangelicals come from. They are afraid of the cultural change they see around them on multiple levels, and they see Trump as fighting back against it and against the elites.
That battle with the elites, that battle with the culture, it has locked them in with a guy who may or may not destroy their movement in the end of the day, I think. There's an argument to be made that and you certainly look at it in the book, that there is a cultural schism happening inside of the evangelical movement right now. I think essentially based on generations, and I'm watching that movement with interest because it's now about to breach two barriers that I think are going to cause a big disruption inside the evangelical movement. The first is the IVF fight, which is, you know, a corollary fight to the overall abortion battle, which they won. They won the battle. They killed Roe v. Wade. And yet, I think the thing that shocks me is not that it happened, because they told us it was going to happen for 50 years. They had a plan from the Federalist Society, and the movement had a plan for 50 years almost to legally overturn Roe v. Wade. And they did it. But there seems like, I mean, there is no contentedness about that. Because immediately, what did you see in the States? It was 15-week ban, 6-week ban, total ban, criminalization. And now it's hit IVF. I'm curious where you think that the overall battle is going on that in the minds of the evangelical white Christian nationalists, and how that affects them more broadly in the political space. I know, I can tell you it's had a big disruption in the Republican female vote. We're seeing it in our polling. We're seeing it in the data in enormous numbers. But I wanted to get your take on that.
This IVF thing is a problem for the anti-abortion movement, especially the most stringent elements of it. Because on the one hand, you know, most Republicans and many independents will describe themselves as pro-life. But what that really means, if you drill down, it means different things to different people. And so the more ideological people believe they have, you know, and some of this is tied to, frankly, Catholic moral theology, which evangelical theology has subsumed to some degree because of the political alliances between Catholics and evangelicals. But without getting too in the weeds on that, I mean, the more ideological opponents of abortion believe that, literally, that life begins at conception, so that an embryo has personhood, has moral significance on the same level as a human being. And if you truly believe that, that does have implications for all sorts of things. You know, not only for abortion at the earliest stages and for any reason, but also for some forms of contraception and in vitro fertilization, which could compromise the success of an embryo that's been created. But this is something that I think the rank and file who call themselves pro-life don't fully understand. And, you know, it just, in terms of marketing, it's, I think for a lot of people in the pews, the idea of being pro-life, being opposed to abortion, letting babies live, that's very appealing. But the idea that you would shut down access to something like IVF that creates babies, well, that doesn't sell very well. And I mean, we see this in polling from people like Kellyanne Conway, a former advisor to President Trump. Overwhelming numbers of white evangelicals support access to IVF. Do they all understand the details of how it works or what it means? And have they sat in a theology class and talked about the moral underpinnings of these questions? Probably not. I mean, who has the time? But it is a sort of an intellectual problem for the movement. And it's becoming a political problem, as you say. People see the real world implications of these laws and policies. And there is a segment of the anti-abortion movement that would like to go much further, and much further than even most Republican voters would like them to go.
Oh, yes.
Right?
I mean, the desperate backpedaling from Kellyanne, even from Donald Trump, who is not a bright man, but he's a cunning sort of guy when he reads a disaster coming toward him, you know, walked it back as quickly as he could. But there does seem to be this sort of Overton window in the policy side of the movement that gets to X and says, well, X is okay, even though we told you X was the end goal, but you know, we got a little bit of X plus one or two or five or seven or whatever. You know, you talked a lot about this, and I want to get back on this topic a little bit. Sort of there's an emergent part of that evangelical movement that leaving the movement doesn't mean leaving your faith. Leaving the movement doesn't mean I'm an atheist now and I enjoy gay abortions and Sharia law, whatever the crazy sort of Fox version of it is, or the crazy like edge case version of it is. Talk to us a little bit about that journey for people, and are they finding a community that's broader than just sort of oh great, you're not, you know, in the edge case anymore. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, the answer is different for everyone. I talk to a lot of people who left evangelicalism for various reasons. Some of them do end up atheists or agnostics, but others end up in other religious communities. You know, one of my friends is an ordained minister. Several people I talk to are part of churches that are, you know, sort of more theologically and politically progressive, more open to questions. As part of my reporting for the ex-evangelicals, I went to a church in Nashville that someone described to me as sort of an ex-evangelical church. And it was interesting because the pastor grew up, I believe, Southern Baptist. A lot of people who go to this church have an evangelical background. So not everyone. There are, you know, lots of queer people. It was multiracial. But the whole idea was to sort of explore spirituality with kind of an evangelical flavor. I mean, there were, you know, songs up on the overhead projector and people raising their hands and a worship band, just like you'd see in the churches I grew up in. But there wasn't an insistence that you have to believe a certain thing. And you know, you can find that other places. You can find that in a Unitarian church. You could find that in a lot of, to some one degree or another, in a progressive mainline Protestant church. But I think for these folks, they wanted to sort of hold on to something that was familiar, and that was how they were doing it. And so I think the answers are, there are as many answers as there are people. You know, for my part, I've spent time in mainline Protestant churches. I talk about in the book, I'm married to a Reformed Jew, so we go to synagogue sometimes. We also go to church on Christian holidays. And so, you know, I think the thing you lose is, you know, there is something really nice and comforting and almost like swaddling about having a community around you that knows what it believes and asserts it, you know, dogmatically. There's a comfort in that structure, and it's a little scary to take that away. But for me, I couldn't stay inside of it and be connected to people I loved, like my grandfather, in the way that I wanted and needed to be, and really in the way that felt loving and right and even Christian to me.
I think that's one of the things that I noted in the book that made it sort of heartfelt was there is a pain in leaving a community. There is a sort of discomfort and transition that you don't know that you're stepping into you don't know that you're ever going to be able to replicate that sense of presence and people and comfort in your life where there's a shared set of values. Even if you're feeling like those values aren't yours anymore, there's still the sense of like you miss it. You miss that world.
And there can be rejection that comes with that from people that you know, love. And I think this is one of the things that I hope the book will communicate, especially for people outside the evangelical world. You know, a lot of people who have a lot of my liberal friends who have no familiarity with this world will ask me, like, why do evangelicals believe this? Why do they do this? Why do people stay in this? And, you know, my book in a way is an answer to this question. Like, it's really hard to leave. It's really painful to leave. And there's a huge personal cost. And it's also giving up a whole subculture. It's not just a set of ideas. It's a culture.
And I know you're born in the Midwest, but a lot of Southern evangelicals, it is even more of a cultural daily part of who they are as people, who their families are, how they interact with their families, their neighbors, their community, that is mediated through that entire experience and that entire sort of space. I wanted to ask you a little bit about what I call business Christianity these days, because it has become, in the evangelical movement, an enormous enterprise. It has become, in many places, in the mega church part of the evangelical movement. And I have a really close friend and a longtime colleague who is, well, I would call him a struggling evangelical. He really is a deeply good-hearted man, but he is, some aesthetic part of him is like, I do not want to go to a church where there are people on wires swinging across, you know, the stage. I don't want to go.
Smoke machines.
I'm not going to church to worship my Lord and Savior. If I'm not going to pick a church based on whether there's a 32-piece orchestra or a 60-piece orchestra, you know, or you know, are there flame pots and sparks when the pastor walks out? That part of the church, it is very easy for outsiders to mock. What is it about that part of the church? Is it just that they want a sort of equally flashy cultural, you know, artifact driven with the same Hollywood technology? Or what is that? I've never understood it.
I think it's, you know, there was a term that was big in the 90s when I was a teenager, which was seeker-sensitive churches, which, like, being sensitive to people who are seeking something spiritually. And I think that's part of it. I think some of it's just straight-up marketing. You know, it is a desire to be flashy and appealing. Of course, there's, I mean, religion in general, including evangelicalism, can be extremely lucrative. And I think that's been a sort of compromising factor for a long time. I will say my parents, and I say this in the book, were very skeptical of the televangelist movement, you know, in the 80s, who were asking people for money and, you know, dressing very flashy. That didn't seem authentic to them. And I have to agree. For me, when I was in my, you know, early 20s and struggling with my faith, I found all of that marketing to be a little, it felt manipulative. I felt like I was being scammed. And it was partly because I was struggling with the fact that I had this gay secular grandfather who we believed was going to hell. And we were praying for him, you know, every day growing up. And then to walk into a church that felt like a little bit like some combination of a carnival and a movie theater and a corporate office product launch, it felt really off-putting. Like if this is really true and this is really important, there should be a seriousness about it, is how I felt. Now, obviously, it appeals to some people. And I think for some people, a church like that is just fun. And I don't begrudge them that. But it was a hard juxtaposition for me with what was really being taught under the surface and the way that things sometimes were presented.
Yeah, I've always found that sort of fascinating, and that emergence of the entertainment enterprise around all these, you know, we've got our cable channel at this mega church and our streaming show, and somebody who did an analysis of a bunch of the political registration stuff on a bunch of mega churches for me one time, in swing states, said these people, they have a deeper reach than you think. He's describing an evangelical church in North Carolina, and he said a mega church. He says they have 60 separate Facebook pages for that church for different things that they do, and they have hundreds and even thousands of members each. It's built this gigantic infrastructure to build that culture for those people. In a more modern vernacular than the tent revival guy.
And it provides something that modern culture has largely destroyed, which is community, right? I mean, we just function so differently than we did, you know, even 50 or 100 years ago. And you can walk into an evangelical church and be put in a small group and be put in a Sunday school group and connected with other moms or whatever. Now, if you don't fit into certain categories, you might not fit in at all. But for those who do, it can be very comforting.
So, Sarah, what do you see the future of the evangelical movement looking like in the country right now?
I love that question. I wish I knew the answer. I think what we can see for sure, there's a lot of data in this book, and I try not to make any predictions, but what we see in the data right now is that white Christianity is on the decline, including white evangelicalism. There's interesting stuff happening with evangelical spaces of color. I think, you know, sort of Black conservative churches are pretty steady. There's a lot of course, because of immigration, the Latino evangelical church is a vibrant space.
Pentecostalism is exploding in a sort of separate faction.
Yeah. And that's that. And there's overlap there. And, you know, the politics are different, though, right? When you inject another culture, another lived experience from the white evangelical experience, the politics get different, are a little bit different, and are a lot different. So that's something I'm curious about and sort of paying attention to. You know, I was talking to Sam Perry, who's a sociologist at the University of Oklahoma and is quoted in the book and is somebody who does a lot of work around evangelicalism that I really admire. And, you know, he was sort of positing, and I think that this may be true, that evangelicalism is kind of becoming now where maybe Catholicism was 20 or 30 years ago, in the sense that when I was growing up, you could be sort of a cultural Catholic or a cradle Catholic and go to church twice a year, and that was it. Whereas in evangelical churches, there was a huge emphasis on, like, that is not enough. That is not true salvation. You have to have a relationship with Jesus. You've got to be in church every Sunday. You know, if you're not, you've got to rededicate your life to Christ. All of this kind of messaging around really being plugged in. But I think that evangelicalism has become so pervasive in some form or another that there are a large number of people like myself who have ties to it, but aren't still, you know, sort of in the system in the way that we once were. And I do wonder how much it sort of becomes a cultural phenomenon exclusively as it becomes more of a political phenomenon. But then the big question is, where do people go spiritually? Because I think people still have many people have the desire for something bigger. And I don't know what that looks like.
I think that's pretty deeply wired into into our culture, our brain chemistry, our design spec as human beings to look for both belief and a community of belief. And so I think that's why this is a really valuable book, Sarah. You sent it to me a couple months ago. I read it in a sitting, basically on an afternoon. And I really appreciate your time today. Folks, the book is The Exvangelicals: Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church by Sarah McCammon. Sarah, thank you so very much for joining us today on The Enemies List. We'll look forward to talking to you again sometime soon.
Thanks so much, Rick.
So I spent the weekend of the 8th, 9th, 10th on my ass, sick as a dog, traveling for a couple months now really hard, and it caught up with me. It wasn't COVID because I'm vaccinated like a human, but the target of my ire at the moment, the target of my boundless, seemingly infinite well of rage at the treason of these people is the Chubb Group. Apparently, the Chubb Group are the people who underwrote Donald Trump's bond for $100 million. Now, why am I mad at them? Why am I angry with them providing Donald Trump with $100 million? Because they're tied to the damn Russians. You'll see more stories about this in the coming days. But the coverage over the weekend that I read is starting to draw the bright line back to the fact that Donald Trump is on the take. He's owned by these people. Of course they came through for him. Of course they did. And whether it was the minimum case of this guy at Chubb approving this and giving him this money, or the maximal case of Vladimir Putin putting in a call to somebody who called somebody who said, "Hey, you're invested heavily in Russian oil and gas, Chubb. Maybe you should help out our boy." Whatever it is, I can't imagine in a billion years that Donald Trump will get the rest that he needs to pay all of it, because the guy is clearly in the pocket of the people he publicly adores, and that's the Russians. And they're always on the damn news list.
Thanks again for listening to The Enemies List. If you have any comments, questions, or if there's someone you'd like to hear on the podcast, hit me up on Twitter at TheRickWilson. Thanks again for the wonderful support you've shown the pod. We're growing fast. It really helps if you will share this with your friends, your family, and anyone else who, like us, is trying to save democracy. While you're at it, if you could rate and review the podcast, I would be very much appreciative. I know this is the sort of thing you've heard a billion times. Please rate, review, like, blah, blah, blah. But you need to do it. It really does help us a lot. We are slaves to the algorithm, my friends. And if you do this, it will help get the pod out further. Anyway, thanks again for listening. I'll see you next time. And remember, whatever you do, stay off the list.